Well, brethren, there is an image of God that this world holds that is subtle in its nature and yet can be very profound in its impact. And in one sense, it's disheartening to think that much of the broader Christian community not only believes in the same view, if you will, but they actually encourage it as part of their teaching and as part of their broader understanding. So what does the world want you to believe about this Christian God, if you will, in air quotes? Most of the world wants you to believe he's a restrictive God, that he's oppressive, that he's demanding. And if you really go down the path far enough, you'll find people that think he's capricious and arbitrary, that his ways and his purpose for your life and for the lives of all of his creation is not designed to actually produce happiness. In fact, it is designed to keep you from happiness and from living a full, rich life. This God is full of a bunch of thou shalt nots, and if you do, then you just get zapped. It's old, antiquated, out of date, and generally not applicable to modern life. As though God is just looking for a reason to exclude you, a reason to condemn you to what they would describe as ever-burning hellfire. Kind of the whole Clint Eastwood mindset, for those who are familiar with Clint Eastwood, the go ahead, make my day moments, of just waiting for you to mess up so he can exact his revenge. That he's just, and if you sort of get into the secular side, they would probably hold more a view of that he's just a mythical antiquarian God created by minds of humans to maintain control over the ignorant. Granted, they don't describe God this way. They wouldn't use many of those. Well, they would use more polite words. But if you listen to them and you listen to how they describe him, his way, and his laws, that's what you'll hear. You'll hear of a very horrible and oppressive God. This is so far out of phase with the true God that is actually a better view and a better description of the devil. It's an upside down view. It's where black is white, good is bad, and down is up. The reality is, God has gifted us. He's gifted everybody in this room, and really, the world doesn't know it yet, but he's gifted them with everything that is needful for a true, full, and abundant life. I want to ask you, has this view, has that type of a view affected your understanding of God? Do we all get impacted by that type of thinking? Because we hear it all the time. The message is there. And again, we won't use those terms. We'd all say, no, sir, we do not do those things. And we should. But the question really is, requires a little more thought and a little deeper thought than just a sort of an off-the-cuff answer. I want to ask you, as we think through that, just two questions. Because before I ask these questions, I have used these terms, and I've definitely heard them used. And in reflecting back on it, even some of the times I've used it, I have actually meant not the most polite thing. So again, two questions, and I'm throwing myself under the bus before I ask them. And again, we're really trying to dig into, are we affected by this? What do you think of when you hear the term the God of the Old Testament? Now again, we say that, and we can mean it, and again, we use that term. I've used it from this very pulpit. But we can begin to think of that as a different God. And we can start looking at the Old Testament thinking, oh, well, he was pretty strict. He was pretty this, and he was. But he's no different than the God we serve today. He's no different than the God that existed before creation. But again, we can start to use that term, and it starts to have the shadow of, well, that God was, he told Israel to go kill everybody. Well, that's bad, right? I mean, we can begin to go down that path. So that's one question. Again, you can think through, when you hear that term, do you see the God that died on a cross out of love? Because that's, sometimes we go, well, that's Jesus. Well, The God of the Old Testament is also Jesus. So again, it's one question. The other one, what do you think of when we hear the term test commandment? Again, we use that term in relationship mostly to the Sabbath. And we use it in a way that says, well, God's testing you with this commandment. And again, that I don't want to pile on. Those can all be valid terms. The question isn't, is it an incorrect term? Because again, it can be used in a very positive way. The question really is, do we begin to look at that and go, wait, well, if God's testing me, where does the logic go? Is he trying to exclude me? Is he trying to see if I fail? And you can go down those paths. Again, we won't get to the point where the world would get to and say, oh, well, your God's just horrible. My question is, are we impacted by it? And do we begin to go down those paths? You know, and it's true. And I've talked to enough people in various different denominations that the term, the God of the Old Testament, is almost a pejorative. It's almost like, well, that God, and you know, and then you get into, well, we got to throw out the law. Well, we got to discard that God. Well, that God's, no, we just want to look at Jesus. Some even won't read the Old Testament. It's as though somehow the God of the New Testament is an improved version of God. And again, that I have heard fairly loud with some folks, and again, different denominations. But again, God is the same now, before, and he'll be the same after this. He does not change. He did not decide that mean, restrictive angle thing didn't work, and now I'm going to try the love angle and see if that somehow works better. It's the same God. I want to take a look at this, and I'm air quoting for those who, I guess online you can see, but anybody that doesn't have video. I'm air quoting the word oppressive God. I want to take a look at what that oppressive God wanted, what his desire was, and what his intention for Israel and for all of us is. I want to look primarily, because we don't have time to get into all, I want to look at the beginning of the nation of Israel, some of the founding articles, if you will, of a nation. And then I want to jump fundamentally to the other end of it and just look at where it ended up and see what God's intention was. What did God want for his people? And equally important and for us today, what does God want for you? No matter how hard your life is, no matter what he is allowing or bringing into your life, what does he want for you? And ultimately, all of humanity. There was a time, again, back in ancient Israel, well, really the beginning of it, it was a time of transition. This was shortly before Moses' death, and he begins to survey the history of Israel. The leadership is transitioning from Moses to Joshua because they're about to enter the promised land. And again, Moses recounts and starts to rewrite this history and telling what all that was going on and all that had transpired leading up to this moment. Many of the people he would have been writing to or would have participated in this conversation would still have memories of the signs and the wonders of the Exodus. Moses records what is commonly referred to as the second law in the book of Deuteronomy, and we'll be turning over there if you want to start heading that way. He reminds them, we won't read all of this again, but he does remind them in his retelling of the story to diligently observe the commandments in the promised land. He says he is doing so, this is God, that your days may be prolonged. Again, we're looking at the inside of what is it God wanted. And he did say, I'm giving you commands and you must do them. So yeah, you can say he was oppressive and he was restrictive. You have to do this. But he's saying, I'm doing it so that your days may be prolonged. For note takers, Deuteronomy 6:2 says that. He says the next verse, that it may be well with you. That's why I'm giving you this. That's why I'm commanding this, so that it's well with you. Deuteronomy 6:3. He wanted it to be generational, something that is passed down, that's reiterated in verse 2. And he says to put it in their heart, Deuteronomy 6:6. Embedded in that in the follow-on instruction to teach the law diligently to the children to our children, God says this. And it's important as we read this, we're going to start in verse 20 again as you're heading that way. Deuteronomy 6, verse 20. But as we read this, keep in mind, I think this is actually again, because I think it's helpful to kind of try to transport yourself back. And if you were the one writing this, you're writing your understanding of what God said, what he did, and what he told you, and what he taught. You're writing it for posterity so that the nation of Israel has it. And you've just been told you can't enter that land. You've just been told, and you're desperately wanting to. And God just says, no, you're going to die here. You can go there. You can look at it over the river, but you can't go in. You might have a cause to feel a little down. You might have a cause to say, well, he doesn't want me to be happy. You might have a cause to say, all I did was strike a rock. Okay, I got a little irritated. I messed up once. Why can't I enter the promised land and have all the grumbling and all the complaints and all the gripes? Keep that in mind. I mean, just sort of the perspective Moses might have as he writes these words. Again, this isn't talking about those instances. I just think it's healthy to understand the person that's probably dictating this, but we'll just say writing it. This was his experience. He was just part of the narrative leading up to chapter 6. He recounts, when I was told, I can't do this. So it was on his mind. Anyway, for our purposes, we're going to pick it up in verse 20 of Deuteronomy 6. And again, let's look for what is it God wanted out of all of this? This horrible, oppressive God of the Old Testament, if you will. Verse 20, he says this, when your sons ask you in times to come, saying, what is the meaning of the testimony and the statutes and the judgments which the Lord your God has commanded you? And again, these are restrictive. You bet. You put a statute out, you put a judgment out, you put a law out, and he commands you to take them. Yeah, there's some restriction there. Then you shall say to your son, we were slaves of Pharaoh in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. And the Lord showed signs and wonders before our eyes, great and severe, against Egypt, Pharaoh, and all his household. Then he brought us out from there that he might bring us in to give us the land of which he swore to our fathers. And the Lord commanded us to observe all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God. Why? For our good always. That's why God gave it. For the good of the people. Again, it flips the narrative. Yes, there are things. Yes, there are restrictions. But God did it for the people. Just like he's done it for us. You don't have a law to keep you from being happy. You don't have a law that says, oh, well, I'm just going to make you miserable for the rest of your life. And then you die and good luck with that. It's for your good. That he might preserve us alive as it is this day. Again, brethren, it's not to harm you. It's not even to keep you from entering the land. It's not to keep you from having a full and enjoyable life. It's for your good, always. And that's an important, a lot of times we'll stop in our head and say it's for our good. He says always. That's an important concept or something for us to think of. Because there are a lot of bad things that are good in the moment, but they're not good always. God wants, and his laws produce good always. Brethren, do we believe this? Do you believe the laws and the commandments and the restrictions that God has put in place are for your good always? This great truth is missed by much of the Christian world. Again, we mention this, but they will tell you the commandments are outdated and oppressive. And they'll even go further, that if you try to live by them, you are earning your salvation. You're trying to prove to God you're good enough, and that alone sets this image that they're just there to restrict you, and if you can somehow get over it, well, then you've earned the right to salvation, which is not at all, again, our understanding, that is not at all what God is doing. They would tell you, if you want happiness and peace, just dump the commandments. Then you don't have the guilt. And again, there's something value to that, to be honest with you. I think we'd be misguided to act like that's not a value. Who wants to carry guilt around with them? Who wants to feel this, like you transgress and you feel shame because you know God watched you transgress. He watched you get drunk. Who wants to carry the guilt of that? Or whatever it is, again, just something that my guess is most people fall into at some point in their life. See, so there is value. But we don't dump the commandments. Do we want to be considered righteous? Verse 25, then it will be righteousness for us if we carefully observe all these commandments before the Lord our God as he has commanded us. Again, brethren, it is for our good. It is for what we have, what God has gifted us with is laws and commandments that give you in the end true freedom. The freedom that every human, that burns in the heart of every human, his ways produce. And brethren, it's not just gifted in the sense, God says, okay, I've given you this, now you gotta begin your journey. You have to start living this way. Yes, our oppressive God does require us to act. He dictates that we obey his command. I'm going to jump forward in the story a little bit. Again, we're very early in the stages of the history of Israel. We're going to jump forward to Deuteronomy chapter 10. Deuteronomy chapter 10. It's interesting, again, these all physically happened to Israel, but metaphorically they all apply to us. The law, the commandments, the statutes, the judgments, those teachings of Christ, the teachings of Paul, all that's written in our Bible is for our benefit and for our health and our future good, if you will. Deuteronomy chapter 10, we'll start in verse 11. Then the Lord said to me, arise and begin your journey before the people, that they may go and possess the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. Just like Israel, it's one thing to sit there at the mountain, if you will. It's one thing to get the commandments. It's one thing to be given that. It's even one thing to say, oh, well, I get it. Okay, those are good. He says, walk. Start your journey. Start living by these. Start obeying me. And there's a promised land coming. We have, metaphorically, we have that same edict in front of us. Start your journey. Get up and march. Brethren, we don't just sit on our knowledge. We can't just sit on the knowledge of what God has asked us to do. And basically, I mean, you could envision sort of the academic that sits in academia all his life but never goes out and applies it. God doesn't give us that option. We must learn it. We must know it. We must look into it. But we also have to get up and start our journey of living by it. Metaphorically, we are being asked to do that every day of our life, to live by what he asks us to do. Verse 12, and now Israel, what does the Lord require of you? So again, you can look at this list and you can say, whoa, that's ridiculous. I am an American and I have my rights and I am free to do what I want. What does the Lord suggest of you? What would the Lord like you to do? What would the Lord wish you would be kind enough to figure out maybe someday you might want to start doing? That's not what it says. He requires you. Okay. So he's restrictive. Okay. You know, the point is you could read this and you could start down two paths. You can say, that's a horrible God. Who would ever serve this God? Because he's requiring this of me. To fear the Lord your God. He requires that. Remember, this is for your good. It's not because he's trying to be, just see if you'll do it. Some arbitrary thing. Fear the Lord your God always. To walk in his ways. To love him. To serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. And to keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes, which I command you this day or today. It's five things that he requires. And if you look at, you know, the thread through it, he requires you to fear him, walk, love, serve, and keep him. He requires you at the deepest possible level to obey him. Again, fear, and we know biblical fear, we'll touch on it here in a minute. It's not cowering. Absolute sovereign reverence of the Lord your God. See, fear, it's not part of my notes today, but fear will do one major thing for you. If you properly fear your God, and it doesn't matter what he says, if he gives you a command, says, obey my Sabbath, keep my Sabbath holy, don't lie, don't steal. And again, we can break those down into the much more granular elements, but at a very high level, you don't even have to understand why he says, remember my Sabbath day to keep it holy. Fear will dictate to you, yes, my Lord, I will do it. I will do what I can. You don't question it because you have a proper reverence and fear for a God that cares for you and looks for the good for you always. The question, again, you can look through these. Does God require this because he's self-centered? Does God require us to do these things because he's narcissistic or an egomaniac and he just wants some people to look to him and go, oh? Is that what God is doing? See, the world looks at this and they see an oppressive God. And again, even many of the Christian denominations will view it this way, as though this is somehow an oppressive God. And I would argue, again, for those of you who have been blessed to be able to get to know some other cultures, I think we in the West, our Western culture, who is steeped and baked in what humans have divined or decided is freedom, we are especially subject to this type of thinking because we worship at the altar of individual freedom. We don't like anybody coming down and telling us how to live our life. We don't like it at all. It's baked into our culture, more so than other nations. Why does he ask us not ask? Why does it require this? We just continue in verse 13. It's the same answer. For your good. Brethren, let those three words sink in. Fearing the Lord is for your good. Walking in his ways is for your good. Loving him is for your good. Serving him is for your good. Keeping his commandments is for your good. God has nothing but your best interest at heart. And I think in one sense, this is probably the most salient point. And it's something, if I could somehow go back, I would love to have been a young person, because I grew up in the church, and have somebody sit me down and tell me this. Tell me that the reason God's doing this is not arbitrary. Young people, obeying God is for your benefit. It's not to please your mom and dad. That will happen, but that's not why you do it. It's for your benefit. God cares for you. He wants you to enjoy the fullness and the richness of life. God is not somehow larger or in a grander God because you obey him. He's not more powerful. He's not more anything. He is literally the sovereign. There is nobody greater than him. To obey him does not enrich him in that sense. It doesn't make him more dominant, and that's, again, that's a completely devilish mindset. He's not greater because you follow his ways. He's given it to you so that you can have a rich and full life. And again, that completely flips it. The closest you can say, and I've thought through this a lot, people that do that and become his sons, yeah, in that sense, his family is growing. But he's still sovereign. He's still all powerful. He's still almighty. There is nobody saying, oh, you got 10 more sons. Here's more power. He's God. He's sovereign. It's all for you. And I figured that out at some point in my life. But I remember sitting there going, man, like, but I want to go out and I had all the stuff I wanted to do. And I couldn't do it. And I did, looking back on it. I didn't think about it at the time, but I saw it as oppressive. That's not why he's given us the law. That's not why he's given any of us. These are the very things that will lead to a meaningful and a rich life for all of us, young or old. Years later, one of the great kings of Israel, who did fully understand, as much as any of us humans can, how God benefited man by giving us the guidepost that governs our lives. And he would write these words. If you want to turn over to Psalms 119. It was the greatest physical king Israel ever had. Listen to how David understood this. Decades later, verse 97 of Psalms 119, he says, "Oh, how I love your law. It is my meditation all the days." Brethren, would you say modern Christianity agrees with that? Would you say they love your law when they say it's been done away with? Do you love the law? Could you say this with the passion and the energy? I love your law. With a big exclamation mark. It is my meditation all the days. Verse 98. You, through your commandments, make me wiser than my enemies, for they are ever with me. I have more understanding than all my teachers, for your testimonies are my meditation. I understand more than the ancients because I keep your precepts. I have restrained my feet from every evil way that I may keep your word. I have not departed from your judgments, for you yourself have taught me. How sweet are your words to my taste, sweeter than honey to my mouth. Through your precepts I get understanding, therefore I hate every false way. Your word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path. Do we see God's, look at the words here. We got commandments, testimonies, precepts, his word, judgments, words, precepts. The words God has given us, the commandments, the judgments, the statutes God has given us, do we see them as a light? Do we see them as illuminating our way? Again, it's an interesting image to think through. We are going down a path. Do we go down it blindly? Do we look at it and go, I know, I don't care. It's leading off to darkness anyway. Like it's only illuminated for ways. I got a better way. I see this shiny thing over here. I want to go after it. I love that better. Because after all, it gives me what I want. I get to do what I want on your Sabbath because, after all, that's what I desire. He says it's a lamp. It guides us in the way. That metaphor will come up here in a minute again. So just squirrel that away in the back of the head. Said I wanted to really focus on the beginning and the fall of Israel. I want to fast forward to the end of the nation of Israel. Again, to the fall of Israel, as we'd say. Obviously, the nation continues. What is God's intention? After all they had done, after all the evil and all the things, and for those who recall the history, and if we haven't, it's worth going back and reading the decline of Israel and into captivity. With all of that, you would think if God was actually arbitrary and capricious, that he would turn on. He's like, I'm done with you. You're out. I don't care. And again, there's that element of it. But that's not all that God is. That's not all that he said. And it's important for us to look at the totality of what had to happen. So let's jump to Jeremiah chapter 32. In one sense, this whole section and much of Jeremiah is interesting because he changed the faces and the names, and we're roughly in the same situation today. This gives us beautiful insights into the God we serve, a God this world simply does not know, and a God that the devil does not want the world to know, nor you to know. And arguably even sadder, a God that at one point in history, Lucifer actually knew. Again, we don't think about that often, but there was a point when Lucifer, the light bringer, actually saw a God that was pure and perfect, because God said, I created you perfect in your ways. You are the sum of knowledge, sum of beauty. I want to start in verse 30, I think, yeah, verse 30. Again, this is sort of the downfall, if you will, but let's look at what God still wants, and it bleeds right into this season of the year that we just wrapped up at the feast. Verse 30 says, because the children of Israel and the children of Judah have done only evil before me from their youth. Think about that line. God, the perfect God that does not, cannot lie, will not misrepresent what was going on, says they have done evil only since their youth. I find that astonishing, because even the most adamant atheist does good in one sense. God characterizes what's going on here as only evil from their youth. For the children of Israel have provoked me only to anger, no pleasing, no provoking to any other emotion but anger. And they've done it for years and decades at this point, with the work of their hands saying to the Lord, for this city has been to me a provocation of my anger and my fury from the day that they built it, even to this day. So I will remove them from before my face. Because of all the evil of the children of Israel and the children of Judah, which they have done to provoke me to anger, they, their kings, their princes, their priests, their prophets, the men of Judah, and the inhabitants of Jerusalem. He's not leaving anybody out of this. They all did it. Verse 33, and they have turned their back, turned to me the back and not the face. Though I taught them, rising up early and teaching them, yet they have not listened to receive instruction. Brethren, God is teaching us. Do we turn our back on Him to do our own will? See, the idea of being able to look at God in the face, there's an authenticity to that. There's that moment says, God, I will do what you tell me to do. I am imperfect, I am flawed, and I'm going to mess up, but I'm going to look to you. I'm going to do what you tell me to do because you're sovereign. And I know what your intention is. He says they turned their back on him. They wouldn't even look at him. Anybody that's had kids, you know, you've had that happen where they're so angry, they're so belligerent, they don't want to look at you. What is the first thing a parent says? Look at me. Every parent does that. Every parent has said that to their child at some point when they're, you know, they have to scold them or whatever. Look at me. God says they turned their back and would not do it. Verse 34, but they set their abominations in the house which they called by my name to defile it. Find that, again, it's just astonishing that they get to the point where the abominations come into the very house of God. Verse 35, and they built the high places of Baal, which are in the valley of the son of Hinnom, to cause their sons and their daughters to pass through the fire of Molech, which I did not command them, nor did it come to mind that they should do this abomination to cause Judah to sin. In one sense, you could stop right there and you could ask the question, which God is oppressive? The God that humans created, Molech, that they sacrifice and they cause their daughters and sons to pass through the fire? The Yahweh, that says, it never even occurred to me to do that. Why would you do that? And yet they say, God is the oppressive one. God is the one that doesn't want you to be happy. Verse 36, now therefore, thus says the Lord God of Israel, concerning the city of which you say, it shall be delivered into the hands of the king of Babylon by the sword, by famine, and by pestilence. And it's an interesting turn here. And again, our focus is, what is it God wanted? He didn't want to have to do this. But as we read in the early part especially, Israel is the one that didn't come through on their covenant agreement. Israel is the one, and Judah is the one that backed out. Here's what God wanted. It turns very millennial, quite frankly. But this is God's desire. even with the description of all that those people did, even with the turning of the back and the refusal to obey and passing their children through the fire, worshiping another God, bringing the abomination into the very temple, God says this, verse 37, "Behold, I will gather them out of the countries where I have driven them in my anger, in my fury, in great wrath. I will bring them back to this place, and I will cause them to dwell in safety." Dwell safely, sorry. God wants them to dwell. That's his desire. Oh, that they would dwell safely. They shall be my people, and I will be their God. See, brethren, that's what God has wanted since the beginning of man. Verse 39. "Then I will give them one heart and one way, that they may fear me forever." Why? Again, why does God want them? Why does God say, "I'm going to give you this one heart, that you have one way, that you can fear me for the good of them and their children after them"? That's what God wants. The good of you, the good of Israel. "And I will make an everlasting covenant with them that I will not turn away." What a covenant. "I will not turn away from doing them good." It's the God of the Old Testament, if you will. And again, that's the phrase, right, I asked earlier about. "I will not turn away from doing them good, but I will put my fear in their hearts so that they will not depart from me." That's the path to life. Again, brethren, fear is not cowering in the corner, as some might think. It's not some abusive situation where you're sitting there looking for the first opportunity to bolt, hoping he gets distracted so you can make it out of the room before he notices. As I mentioned a moment ago, this is a face-to-face fear that is extremely and extraordinarily genuine and authentic before your God, where nothing is off limits, no topic, no concern, no issue, where your days are ordered, your life has purpose and meaning. Even the difficulties come along and you see meaning in them because God's illuminating the path. If he says something, we simply believe him. It's astonishing. Let's read verse 41, because he goes on, "Yes, I will rejoice over them to do them good." God says it's not almost enough to just be like, "All right, well, you got a good life. God, the sovereign of the universe, is going to rejoice over you to do you good. "And I will assuredly plant them in this land with all my heart and with all my soul." That's what God wants. That's what he always wanted. That's what he wants for us. To do you good. And he's going to rejoice over that. See, brethren, this is the God that has given us the way to live. He's given us his laws, his commandments. Again, we don't want to go through the whole list. He's given us the way that leads to true life. You have that knowledge. You have that. God has seen fit to open your mind to understand it. Many, many Christians, quite frankly, have it. They have the way to life, to true happiness, to true joy, to true peace. And this is what God has promised you. If you overcome, that you will be his son. That's your future. A natural born child of God. Yet this world and this system wants you to believe that's simply not so. They want you to believe, quite frankly, in some cases, the opposite. They want you to believe that he is not interested in your happiness, your joy, your excitement. And again, that he shackles you to the misery of life of servitude. For no other reason than just to see if you can do it. God's way, jumping to the New Testament now, is described as being narrow, which of its very nature means, yes, it is restrictive. Yes, it is constrained. So brethren, as we sit here today, what does this have to do with us, aside from gaining a slightly sharper image of the God we serve? After all, we live in a modern society, and all that's ancient history. We have just come through the fall holiday season, where we are reminded that God has told us to seek first His kingdom of God, or His kingdom, and His righteousness. Brethren, there is only one path. There is a narrow path, and it is a difficult path. No question about it. But its end is life. We know the verses. I'll just read them to you. Math for note takers. Matthew 7:13-14 says, "Enter by the narrow gate. For wide is the gate and broad is the way that leads to destruction. And there are many who go in by it. Because narrow is the gate and difficult is the way which leads to life. And there are few who find it." The kingdom is His vision. And as the way the New Testament words it, Christ is the way. Turn over to John chapter 14. Because as Jesus was getting ready to leave this world, Thomas asked a fundamental question. One that, brethren, one way or the other, every person that has sought God has asked. You may not have worded it this way, I get that. I don't know that I have. I haven't sat down and put this question up and started trying to figure out an answer. But one way or the other, we have asked in our own heads this question. Thomas's question is, how can we know the way? How can we know? The answer is of vital importance to all of us. John chapter 14, we'll start in verse 1. He says, "Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go and prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may also be," or be also. "And where I go and the way you know." See, this is our great hope. Thomas, and this is the question. Thomas said to him, "Lord, we do not know where you are going. How can we know the way?" And this is the answer for all of us. Jesus said to him, "I am the way. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." You talk about restrictive. You talk about oppressive. He just said there's no other way to come to God except through Him. There's no other path to the future and life except through Christ. He is the way. The only way. And as we've already established from looking at the Old Testament, there's lots of scriptures in the New Testament we could also look at. But that way is for your good, always. Can I keep coming back to that phrase? Because it's so important for us to understand, because the drag of life, the pulls, the trials, the problems, the health issues, all the things that we can get bogged down in, God's illuminating your path. And He's asking you to walk down it for your good. You learn so much in those things. It is only after the fact, unfortunately, I think. It is only after the fact. Luke 13:24 says, "Strive to enter through the narrow gate. For many, I say to you, will seek to enter, but will not be able." Brethren, it is something we must strive for. I ask myself in my head all the time, do I do that? Do I actually strive to enter through the narrow gate? Or is it just a little cliche we can throw around and we got it memorized? Strive to enter through the gate and blah, 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 blah. Do you strive? Because the gate is narrow. There's one way and it's little. But it leads to life. Again, it's not narrow because He wants to just keep you from joy and happiness. It is literally the gate that leads to those things. Another way of saying it, there's 20 billion ways to produce misery, sorrow, death, and pain. And there's one that will produce happiness, always. I say happiness will produce godly joy and godly love, always. Happiness is a byproduct. He wants you to go down the path. He wants you to go through that gate. Brethren, if we agree that God wants us to enter, then instead of being an oppressive and mean God, it is the person that cannot let go of something that prevents us from going down the path and entering through that gate. It is us. And we need to clearly understand that. God's not put something on us that says, well, I'll put the scarlet letter on you, and with that, you're just not getting through. Sorry. It's the baggage we won't get rid of. It's the thing in your life that you say, God, I don't care. This, I need this. It's more important than doing your will that's going to prevent it. Because he does say many will try, but not be able to. Yes, brethren, the way is narrow. It is restrictive. Yes, even, and you'll hear this too, it is closed-minded. But consider this. God, with his infinite intellect, more than the collective knowledge of all the spiritual creatures or the natural-born creatures that have ever existed or ever will exist, has thought through every one of those other ways of doing things. Everything you can conceive of, every other path, every other way. And he's come to the conclusion, and he's thought it through again to the nth degree, and it produces sorrow, and it produces misery. I believe God's considered all of that. I believe he considered that before time began. And he's not restricting us. He's gifting you with the way to live. He's gifting you with the things that will produce life. It's an important, important, fundamental component of a Christian life, if you will, to understand that is what God is doing for you. The commands and the things he asks of you is to do you good in the end. See, God's way is light. It is steady. It is sure. It never changes. Now, it won't change in the millennium. It's not different in the Old Testament, and it won't be different for all eternity. It is steady. It is sure. It is illuminating, and it's universally true for everyone in this room and everybody that has ever and ever will live. All those in the millennium, their eyes will just be open to that reality. Yours are open now. What are we doing with it? What are we doing with that knowledge? The devil's way, our way, if you will, Satan's way. Lots of metaphors, I suppose. The one I like, it's like a firework. We've all had this experience. We're sitting in somewhere, dark of nights, best time for fireworks. Anticipation builds as you see this little streamer going up. You know what's coming. Everybody does. You see a bright cloud or colorful blast. You hear the percussion of sound. Then it all disappears into the distant glow of that firework, and the sound echoes into the distance. And when it's over, you're left with more blackness than you can imagine. That's what the devil has to offer. Because, again, I think it's a mistake to say the devil doesn't have an appealing cause. He has something to offer that seems good for that moment. And even if you want to take that metaphor and expand it out into the whole of the 4th of July fireworks show, we all know there's this big crescendo happening at the end. What happens when it's all over? It all goes, and the skies go quiet. Smoke drifts off and everybody goes home. It's a metaphor that can help us understand what Satan does offer you. And it is exciting. It is thrilling. It is beautiful. It is joyful in the moment. But again, you're left in the black of darkness, so to speak. See, again, it's juxtapose that with the guideposts God gives you that are the same ones that he would have given Adam and Eve if he gave them the full law, which, as we understand, he gave them enough to live by. It's the same ones they'll live by in the millennium. And they illuminate and they give you the guide and they give you the path forward to the eyes have not seen and the ears have not heard what the glory of God has in store for you. See, the devil wants to give you the thrill now. He wants you to enjoy it, and you will. Young people, you will. There is so much this world has to offer that is joyful in the moment. But that's where it ends. One final thought. I alluded to it earlier. Don't confuse knowledge of the path with movement down the path. Brethren, we are told not to stand. We are told to move. And it is too often we act like being on the path is, in fact, entering through the narrow gate. By the very metaphor he gave us of a path, we are intended to walk down it. And the way I would envision it, you know, metaphorically, there's a gate at the end of that. Turn to Luke 13. Actually, I'll just read this one to you. It's one verse, and we're running short, I think. Luke 13, 24 says this. He says, strive to enter through the narrow gate. For many, we read this earlier. So just, again, just bringing it to mind again, because again, it's something we strive for. Enter through the narrow gate. For many, I say to you, will seek to enter and will not be able. See, we'll seek to enter. That's an interesting, don't have time to deal with it. They know enough to seek it. We know enough to seek it. And again, it's something we ought to, we need to be asking ourselves, I think, regularly. And I don't know why coming off this feast, it was just something that was on the mind. Do I seek it? Do I strive for this? Am I walking down that path? Because God says some will seek it and not be able to. I do want to turn to this one. Luke chapter 19. Luke chapter 19, we'll start in verse 11. It's a kingdom parable, one we're very familiar with. But again, it's not sufficient to be on the path. Knowledge of the holy, knowledge of God's way, knowledge of an understanding of his laws, his ways, his principles, without putting them into action is insufficient. We must react. We must take action. Again, this parable, I think, does a good job of highlighting that. Luke 19, we'll start in verse 11. Again, we're very familiar with this. Now, as they heard these sayings, he spoke another parable because he was near Jerusalem and because they thought the kingdom of God would appear immediately. Therefore, he said, a certain nobleman went to a far country and received for himself a kingdom and to return. So he called 10 of his servants, delivered to them 10 minas, and said to them, do business till I come. Again, do business. He didn't say just hold it. We work, we labor, what he has gifted us with, we do something with it. Verse 14, but his citizens hated him and sent a delegation after him saying, we will not have this man reign over us. And so it was when he returned, having received the kingdom, he summoned these servants to whom he had given the money to be called to him, that he might know how much every man had gained by trading. Then came the first saying, master, your mina has earned 10 minas. And he said to them, said to him, well done, good servant, because you were faithful in very little, have authority over 10 cities. Again, very little, you know, and it's hard to imagine, but you know, I don't know what, you know, 10 mina is worth at the time. I know you can look that up. But in the age of, you know, billion-dollar, multi-trillion-dollar deficits and hundreds of billion dollars of individual wealth, just imagine it's like $1,000 that you're given. And you're told to go figure this out, work with it, labor with it, and again, go down the path. Work and labor till he comes, too. So it's another thing that periodically goes around that, well, we can stop working. Well, we just got to hunker down because the world's getting so bad. We got, you know, it's not what he says. Yeah, the world's bad. Yeah, your work's going to be oppressive. Yeah, they're going to come after you in school. Yeah, they're going to come after you. Like a lot of things are coming your way. He says, work until I come. Not until it gets hard. And then just hunker down. Work till we come. Because there is a great reward coming. Verse 18, and the second came saying, master, your mina has earned 5 minas. Likewise, he said to him, you also be over 5 cities. Verse 20. Then another came saying, master, here is your mina, which I have kept put away in a handkerchief. For I feared you because you were an austere man. You collect what you did not deposit and reap what you did not sow. Here is somebody, brethren, who has a completely improper view of God in the wrong possible way. Someone who did not understand that it was necessary to move down the path or to do business is the way it's worded here. Somebody who did not understand what you are given, you are expected to do something with it. You are expected to produce something. And he said to him, out of your own mouth I will judge you, you wicked servant. You knew. Since, again, it's worth unpacking this someday. But you knew I was an austere man, collecting what I did not deposit and reaping what I did not sow. You knew this. And you still didn't go down the path. You still didn't move. You sat on the knowledge that you have. And you let the world, and again, this is really talking about a neutral, but there's also the possibility of sliding back, if you will. Why then did you not put my money in the bank that I, at my coming, I might have collected it with interest? See, God's not interested in you remaining where you are. Brethren, we have to keep our eye on the kingdom, and we have to move forward. We have to take the gifts God has given us, of his laws, his commandments, his statutes, and in the big umbrella, his way, his truth, his way, Christ at the top of that hierarchy, if you will. We have to move toward that. We have to keep that in mind. Young or old, move. Take the journey. Wherever you are, take the next step. Don't stagnate. It's an admonition. I look at my own life and I find too many times where I'm just like, it's just easy. It's just easy to stop. After all, whatever you think, I don't know. I don't even know how to articulate it. I just know sometimes I look around and go, I haven't done much in a while. Brethren, this is something we will need to learn for all eternity. Think about that. Will it be over when you become a child of God, a full-born child of God? Brethren, we have to stay on the narrow path. We have to seek the narrow gate. They lead to life fulfilled in this time, in this age, and life eternal for all ages to come. Because we strive for it today. We will teach this in the world tomorrow, and brother, we will be living his way for all eternity.